Okay, excellent. Well, it's great seeing you. Jean and Grace Hale from our history department were fellow students many years ago, working with Jackson Lears, a UVA undergraduate,
right.
At Rutgers, and I know that she's sent some of her students over as well. Look, I'm really excited about this seminar, and thank you for coming down.
You're welcome.
Jean doesn't really need an introduction, but I'll give you a brief one. He's a professor in the Humanities College and associate director of the Honors Program at Villanova University. I know some of you in ethics are on the job market. You've seen a fabulous job at Villanova. Jean is not on the search committee.
But I know people who are.
But he knows people who are, so we'll do what we can later on that. He has written for numerous periodicals, Books and Culture, Commonweal, Dissent, The Nation, Tribune, our own Hedgehog Review. Jay Tolson, who's the editor of the Hedgehog Review, will be over presently. He's, I think, trying to crush a deadline, but mutual fans, I understand, and you've written for him mm-hmm. and for his predecessor, Jennifer Geddes, who ran the Hedgehog Review before. Your book, Christian Critics, A Religion and the Impasse in Modern American Social Thought, came out with Cornell University Press some years ago. I guess this was around 2001. Have just been singing the praises of this remarkable book for more than a decade now. I have required every graduate student that I've worked with to read it, and also in preparation for comprehensive exams. It's just a fabulous book, and you know, I don't know how many of you have read Professor McCarer's work, but the prose is also just dazzling, and there's wonderful moments of humor. And it's the only single volume history of American theological thought that I know from covers the years of the social gospel through radical orthodoxy, Christian Critics. I am pretty purchased every available used copy. I know I've bought at least 50 used copies over the years. I am thrilled to let you know that after 12, 14 years of work, you've reached the end of the manuscript, this major work that is now in the hands of Jean's agent, but hopefully will soon be landed with a terrific publisher, and will be in our midst sometime in the next year. The title of that is The Enchantments of Mammon, Capitalism as the Religion of Modernity. You know, we've read teasers over the past 10 years in various places, but there is much that we haven't seen. The book manuscript, I understand, is weighing in at over 300,000 words.
Moby Dick.
Which Jay Tolson comes out to 750 pages at this point. So you and Jay may want to work on author and editor, but I'm thrilled, and congratulations to you on this.
Thanks.
So today, we are thrilled to have you come and talk about Reinhold Niebuhr. We'll have 45 minutes, 50 minutes, as long as you need for your talk. We'll then take a break for 5 or 8 minutes. If you need to run down to Starbucks, that's fine. Reconvene for another 45 minutes of Q&A. So a warm welcome, literally, and emotionally to you, and thanks for making the train ride down from Philly late last night. Welcome.
Thanks for that introduction, Charles. It's great to see you again.
That's great seeing you.
Before I begin, I'm supposed to convey some remarks. Isn't it curious that Charlie Gillespie is a Marxist? I was assured that was going to get a punchline when he got Charlie got married on Saturday. Okay. Unlike Mark Antony and Julius Caesar, I have come both to praise and to bury Reinhold Niebuhr. The praise I will offer is genuine, but the internment I think is long overdue. For Niebuhr continues to cast, in my view, far too restrictive and censorious a specter over our public intellectual life. Take, for example, his beloved Serenity Prayer. Oh, no, not the Serenity Prayer. You're not going to go that one, are you? Yes, I am. Take his beloved Serenity Prayer, which encapsulates the wisdom, but also hints at the shortcomings of his political theology. God grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, courage to change the things I can, and wisdom always to know the difference. Now, that's a memorable chestnut of popular piety, oft-cited and admired as a wizening maxim of existential and political maturity, and its stoical spirit has been invoked by a roster of intellectuals and politicians. As with so many of Niebuhr's pronouncements, we're all expected to stroke our chins and furrow our brows at the wise man's gravitas, and to take to heart his reminder that our sin and finitude place inexorable limits on our ability to master for good the vicissitudes of history. As I explained in my first book, and will emphasize again today, there are good reasons why Niebuhr is the perennial theological favorite of very serious people, those entrusted to wield or plump for the powers and principalities of rule, violence, and imagination. Would we not want them to be serene and courageous and wise about when to be one or the other? Yet this prayer also reflects everything, I think, anemic and debilitating about Niebuhr's political thought. As the course of Niebuhr's career from socialist prophet to establishment cleric suggests, the serenity it counsels turns far too easily into complacence and resignation. The courage, it affirms, flexes its muscles within far too narrow a compass. And the serenity congeals and the courage withers because the wisdom they demand, otherwise known as Christian realism, derives from canons of reality as defined by very serious people. While I certainly agree that Niebuhr articulated an incisive critique of the liberal Protestant social gospel, and that he offered a salutary, if often unheeded, chastisement of the pretensions of Cold War liberalism, I also think that his political theology cannot provide what we need for our time. As a cleric of what Henry Luce dubbed the American century, Niebuhr quite deliberately intended to lower our expectations of political agency, to circumscribe and even smother the fires of the era's incendiary political hopes, to constrict and even abort the political imagination, and to inhibit the enlargement of political possibility. As that American century is, I believe, entering the climacteric of its descent and demise, Niebuhr's work offers little but a snare and impediment to the work of political imagination and reconstruction on which we have to embark in the coming decades. So redolent of resignation and sobriety, he cannot help us ignite the renaissance of political hope that I think we so desperately need. A theological connoisseur of irony, Niebuhr may well have appreciated the winding denouement of his political career, for he began as a Protestant firebrand, inveighing against liberal judiciousness and lethargy. It's become almost impossible for us to imagine Niebuhr apart from the unsentimental and at times cynical political intelligence of moral man and immoral society, but it's worth recalling that during the previous decade and a half, as the pastor of Detroit's Bethel Evangelical Church, he had been one of the bright young hopes of the social gospel, eagerly rattling the teacups in the vicarage of liberal Protestant rectitude. Both religious and secular liberals had become tiresome bores in Niebuhr's anything but humble opinion. In a letter to the New Republic published in the summer of 1919, Niebuhr lamented what he called liberalism's gray spirit of compromise. Provided with an auspicious moment for social reconstruction in the aftermath of World War I, liberals, Niebuhr charged, balked at the opportunity to, quote, tear down old houses and build new ones. Liberals lacked fervency, in his view, that, quote, spirit of enthusiasm, not to say fanaticism, which is so necessary to move the world out of its beaten tracks. Once the vehicle of youthful political exuberance, liberalism was now, Niebuhr mocked, a philosophy of the middle-aged. These brazen high spirits animated Niebuhr's pastorage of Bethel Evangelical, a tenure that both catapulted him into national prominence and served as the crucible for his political theology. They galvanized his rarely cited campaign against the Ku Klux Klan, his criticism not only of Henry Ford, but of Fordist management and mechanization. and his support for the city's labor unions, to the point not only of joining them on picket lines, but of granting organizers access to his pulpit. This is the Niebuhr who embraced pacifism, served as national chairman of the Fellowship of Reconciliation, and joined other liberal Protestants such as Kirby Page, Sherwood Eddy, and Harry Ward in advocating socialism. Long after Niebuhr moved to New York in 1928, assumed his post at Union Theological Seminary, and entered the long durée of realism inaugurated by the publication of Moral Man, the radical enthusiasm and critical edge that marked his letter to the New Republic remained in unmistakable, albeit diluted, forms. Niebuhr's embrace of Marxism, together with his enlistment in the more militant wing of the Socialist Party, testifies to the persistence of this radical bravado. Yet his disdain for liberal Protestantism is so palpable in Moral Man that it's easy to forget that, as Niebuhr asserted plainly in the introduction, quote, "The ultimate purpose of this book is to find political methods which will offer the most promise of achieving an ethical goal for society." That latter phrase inflected more by Protestant moralism than by Marxist dialectic. We should keep in mind that Niebuhr's excoriation of pacifism in Moral Man appeared in the midst of a reflection on religious resources for social and political transformation. Likewise, his moral equivalence of violent and nonviolent coercion, however dubious or incisive we may consider it, was intended to clarify the issues at stake, not to, quote, "lame the nerve of action," as he put it in Reflections on the End of an Era a couple of years later. Even though he left the Fellowship of Reconciliation in 1934, Niebuhr helped to found the Fellowship of Socialist Christians in 1931 and remained a member well into the 1940s. Niebuhr may have thought many of his Protestant and secular colleagues deluded in one way or another, but he was generous enough to write in Moral Man that, quote, "The modern communist's dream of a completely egalitarian society is a secularized, but still essentially religious, version of the classical religious dream." Now, Niebuhr's invocation of dreams would seem incongruous in a volume considered an urtext of realism, but I've come to think that the most trenchant and unassailable insight of Moral Man lies neither in its indictment of pacifism, nor in its discussion of nonviolent resistance, nor in what Christopher Lash, enlisting Niebuhr's own words, praised as its armature for, quote, "a spiritual discipline against resentment." Now, I think the most trenchant insight remains its passages on illusion and myth, the realm of political imagination, as David Graeber might remind us. Myth was a salient topic among American intellectuals in the 1930s. Kenneth Burke's call for a revolutionary symbolism, John Dewey's search for a common faith, C.L.R. James' ruminations on the cultic quality of mass entertainment, or Thurman Arnold's sardonic examination of the folklore or spiritual government of capitalism. Anticipating all of them, as well as echoing George Sorel, Niebuhr's moral and political psychology in Moral Man emphasizes not rationality or interest, but imagination. Human beings, Niebuhr mused, are, quote, "governed more by imagination than by reason, and imagination is compounded of mind and impulse." Especially when it assumes political form, imagination invents illusions, as Niebuhr calls them, which Niebuhr defines not as fantasy or chimera, but rather as what you could call an enacted fiction, something one, quote, "believes to be true and is not wholly true, but ought to be true and may become true if its truth is not doubted." Something like the imagination of Samuel Coleridge or Wallace Stevens. Illusion would seem to be a way in which we discern some genuine possibility in reality that is unseen with the eyes of rationality. Our action based on that vision, and vision is of something, which is why visionary is someone who sees, can bring that gestating reality to birth. This is what Niebuhr appears to mean when he writes that, quote, "the truest visions of religion are illusions." It's worth recalling that Moral Man ends on a note of intoxication rather than sobriety. Quote, "the most effective agents will be men who have substituted some new illusions for the abandoned ones. The most important of these illusions is that the collective life of mankind can achieve perfect justice." It is a very valuable illusion for the moment, for justice cannot be approximated if the hope of its perfect realization does not generate a sublime madness in the soul. Nothing but such madness will do battle with malignant power and spiritual wickedness in high places. The illusion is dangerous because it encourages terrible fanaticisms. It must therefore be brought under the control of reason. One can only hope that reason will not destroy it before its work is done. If, as the saying goes, one governs in prose, Niebuhr was quite well aware that one revolts as well as campaigns in poetry. Niebuhr's account of the promise and perversity of imagination leavened his later work as well, especially The Irony of American History. To be sure, this book was Niebuhr's quintessential statement of a gray-flanneled Cold War liberalism. Indeed, it elevated and assured his stature among the Nestors of the post-war intellectual and political establishment. But it also extends the analysis of illusion that he crafted as a Protestant socialist from the terrain of class warfare to the topography of American nationalism. Though adamantine in his conviction that American power and resolve were the only realistic bulwarks against the Soviet Union and revolutionary socialism, Niebuhr was equally insistent that the nation's most pernicious illusion, its, quote, form of spiritual pride, in his words, was its sense of exceptionalism, its conviction of providential anointment, and its delusional belief in its historical innocence. Along with a cohort of contemporaries, from Perry Miller to Ernest Tuvison, Niebuhr observed with profound ambivalence that, quote, from the earliest days of its history to the present moment, there is a deep layer of messianic consciousness in the mind of America. In Niebuhr's view, the mythology of exceptionalism underlay the American identification of material success with virtue and divine favor, and energized its Promethean effort to be, quote, the master of destiny at home and abroad. Now armed with a nuclear arsenal, the United States could no longer afford to subscribe to this farrago of what Niebuhr himself called sentimentalities and pretensions. One consequence of the exceptionalist illusion, about which Niebuhr was especially prescient, I think, was the use of economic growth to evade rather than resolve social conflict. What Elizabeth Cohen has dubbed the post-war consumers' republic grew in part, in Niebuhr's view, from the exceptionalist dependence on capitalist prosperity as a sign of national anointment. Quote, every ethical and social problem of a just distribution of the privileges of life is solved by so enlarging the privileges that either an equitable distribution is made easier or a lack of equity is rendered less noticeable. The ever-escalating expansion of productivity and consumption in order to pacify class conflict was, by the 1950s, a staple of liberal social thought and politics, a hope ballasted by the apparent stability provided by the New Deal order, the hegemony of Keynesian economics among intellectuals, and the unprecedented material abundance and technological innovation that marked what historians have called the golden age of capitalism. Niebuhr was one of the few liberal thinkers who suspected that the golden age, and by extension the sense of exceptionalism, would be short-lived. Quote, this expansion cannot go on forever, Niebuhr warned. And ultimately, we must face some vexatious issues of social justice in terms which will not differ too greatly from those which the wisest nations of Europe have been forced to use. America would discover that the vices and antagonisms it thought it had left behind in Europe would not so much return as make their presence known with an unsettling and potentially explosive rudeness. Indeed, even the social mobility that had been a fixture of American mythology would wither as economic sclerosis set in, as Niebuhr predicted ruefully when he wrote that, quote, the American class structure will become more fixed as the nation moves toward the final limits of an expanding economy. Niebuhr could be just as far-seeing about the trajectory of containment, the diplomatic and military analog to the suppression of class conflict through prosperity. And he aimed his most acerbic critique of Cold War policy at the horrific folly of the war in Vietnam. The global extension of American power had entangled us, he recognized, in, quote, a vast web of history in which other people's, quote, running in oblique or contrasting directions to our own, inevitably hinder or contradict what we most fervently desire. Yet because the United States had so little experience navigating what he called the endlessly complex compounds of ethnic loyalties, historic traditions, military strength, and ideological hopes, Niebuhr feared, and he's anticipating here the insight of Graham Greene in The Quiet American, whose narrator said of his young CIA friend that, quote, "I have never met a man who had better motives for all the trouble he caused." Niebuhr feared that this nation would, quote, "move with one direct leap from the use of economic to the use of military power." When the U.S. did precisely this in Vietnam, Niebuhr took to the pages of the New Republic in January 1966 to declare that the war was, quote, "an impossible military and moral dilemma," and that the Johnson administration should desist from escalating American involvement. Now, Niebuhr's admonition here would seem to confirm not only his reputation as a steely-eyed sage, but the stature of Christian realism as a template for politics and a bridle on American hubris. Niebuhr warned that, however righteous American opposition to communism, the United States must bridle its own aspiration to master history, an ambition that is always a prideful and insidious illusion. Acting, so this tale goes, as a prophet to the national security state, Niebuhr urged American leaders to cultivate a twofold sense of irony, an appreciation of unintended consequences, and a capacity to identify the self-interest hidden under the noblest professions of selflessness. Suspicious of idealism of any kind, Niebuhr insisted that politicians seek limited, proximate goals, not the grandiose and utopian objectives pursued by empires or revolutionaries. Such ideals always represented, in his view, an impossible and dangerous transposition to groups of standards appropriate to individuals. Quote, "It is not within the realm of moral possibility to ask a nation to be self-sacrificing." Thus, according to Christian realism, the inevitable clashes of self-interested groups could be tempered but never eliminated, and peace could be achieved through the alignment of interest with interest, not a larger transformation of heart. By the same token, since idealism could both inflate one's own sense of righteousness and demonize one's opponents, realism about group self-interest would diminish rather than encourage violence. Niebuhr counseled humility, irony, and realism in part out of an eschatological modesty, a reticence that rendered foolish any blueprint or schedule of history's consummation. Writing in the chilliest days of the Cold War, Niebuhr feared that Americans, quote, "lack the humility to accept the fact that the whole drama of history is enacted in a frame of meaning too large for human comprehension or management." Indeed, to Niebuhr, the mythology of exceptionalism was more than a form of immodesty. It was an act of idolatry in which Americans worshipped their own graven image and likeness. Quote, "No society, not even a democratic one, is great enough or good enough to make itself the final end of human existence." Only repentance of this self-deification could divert Americans from the path of folly. And once shorn of their idolatrous illusions about their nation's power, wisdom, and destiny, they could use their immense resources with greater prudence and generosity. Similarly, Niebuhr's opposition to pacifism stemmed not only from his aversion to idealism, but from a particular political ontology. Like imperialists and revolutionaries, pacifists, Niebuhr thought, were naive in their conviction that ideals could be enacted in the turbulent contingencies of history. When David Dellinger and other pacifist students at Union were expelled in 1940 for refusing to register for the draft, Niebuhr preached a sermon condemning not their lack of patriotism, but their, quote, "arrogance." Putting the wisdom of serpents before the gentleness of doves, Niebuhr's realism could both sanction intimidation, violence, and deceit, and enjoin Christians to beg forgiveness for the commission of these necessary evils, because it refused to grant any political significance to love. Speaking especially to religious pacifists, Niebuhr asserted in the first volume of The Nature and Destiny of Man that, quote, the law of love stands on the edge of history, not in history. It represents an ultimate and not an immediate possibility. For Niebuhr, time was relentlessly linear, unilinear. We have no access to the fullness of love that awaits us at the end of history. Love's appearance in our time could only be partial at best. Agape must always defer to realpolitik. As Bertolt Brecht put it, those who preached kindness cannot themselves be kind. Both Niebuhr's political ontology and his eschatology rest on a secular temporality. Empty, homogeneous time, in Walter Benjamin's words. Plodding and unredemptive, in which love will have to wait until the end of history, when all obstacles to its sway have disappeared. Until then, politics could only be, at best, an unending and often violent vocation in damage control. This is the Niebuhr who continues to exercise a spell over politicians and intellectuals. From presidents, Jimmy Carter and Barack Obama both cited him as a major influence, to philosophers, theologians, and historians, Paul Ramsey, Jean Bethke Elstein, Richard John Neuhaus, and Andrew Bacevich, the latter Niebuhr's most able and sensitive contemporary acolyte, whose critique of American exceptionalism echoes that of the irony of American history. Yet the fact that such a spectrum could invoke Niebuhr should elicit not marvel at his bipartisan appeal, but rather suspicion of his bipartisan appeal, just as we should always be suspicious of anything bipartisan. Aside from Bacevich, perhaps, the Niebuhrians I just cited have comprised a roster of faithful imperial stewardship, willing and even eager to justify the most horrendous and inept of imperial crusades. So as sympathetic as I am to Niebuhrian appeals for greater modesty and self-restraint, I'm doubtful that Christian realism can really moderate or constrain imperial ambition. In his laudable eagerness to find historical precursors for his own critiques of empire, Bacevich overlooks some real and intractable problems with his hero's work. Niebuhr adopted a fundamentally contradictory stance during the Cold War. On the one hand, condemn American illusions of innocence and omnipotence, yet on the other hand, and at the same time, endorse a realistic posture against communism that entailed both the possible use of nuclear weapons and the repression of post-colonial revolutionary movements. Despite his imprecations against the reckless pride of American globalism, Niebuhr's conception of Cold War international politics as a never-ending conflict in which the children of light would have to employ the weapons of the children of darkness made it difficult for him to oppose anything the United States did. Niebuhr himself realized that calls for humility and circumspection on the part of American leaders were perfectly compatible with global dominion. Writing in Luce's Life magazine in September 1948, Niebuhr mused that, quote, we will have to stand at every point of our far-flung lines. Later noting in the irony of American history that Egyptian and Mesopotamian city-states, quote, were responsible for the order and cohesion of these first great empires in human history, Niebuhr opined that, quote, the preponderant power of America may have a similar role to play in the present international scene. Indeed, sounding eerily like neoconservatives, Niebuhr contrasted what he called the buoyant vigor of American culture both to the spiritual tiredness of Europe and, God help us, the defeatism of Oriental cultures. Note well that Niebuhr did not explicitly call upon the U.S. to withdraw its combat forces from Vietnam. This was not, I think, a mere default of logic. It was more fundamentally a default of imagination, a capitulation to the canons of realism enunciated by the military-industrial leviathan of the post-war corporate commonwealth. Niebuhr's demurral on Vietnam was indicative of his habitual deference to the ideological and political parameters set by the Cold War establishment, of which he was a charter member. Niebuhr could not and never did see how the debacle in Vietnam stemmed from the very notions of communist malevolence and American indispensability that he shared with other liberal intellectuals, politicians, and policymakers. Like his fellow Cold Warriors, Niebuhr never really questioned the tenets of Wilsonian liberal internationalism, itself a progeny of that messianic impulse that Niebuhr otherwise knew to be a source of terrible fanaticism. We and the rest of the world are paying the price for American denial of and inattention to the intractable realities of the post-colonial world that was emerging in the wake of the Versailles Treaty and the end of the Second World War. At the same time, and by the same token, Niebuhr could not endorse a more radical reorganization of American society because he shared with liberals a truncated sense of political possibility, acquiescing in the circumscribed account of what was realistic. He and other liberal intellectuals counseled either resignation to malignant power or a decent modesty in its reform, anything but a, quote, sublime madness that he now castigated as either ineffectual or murderous. His abandonment of any meaningful socialist politics was bound up with an overvaluation of expertise, something endemic, I would contend, both to the liberal Protestant social gospel and to the entire progressive liberal lineage of American social and political thought, from John Dewey and Thorsten Veblen to Daniel Bell, John Kenneth Galbraith, and Cass Sunstein. To be fair, Niebuhr was no technocratic ideologue. In The Irony of American History, for instance, he warns against America's, quote, cult of technical efficiency, and insists that, quote, we are more desperately in need of genuine charity than of more technocratic skills. Yet an inclination toward managerialist politics was evident in Niebuhr's writing as early as the 1920s, but it surfaced most clearly during the Second World War. In his book, The Children of Light and the Children of Darkness, Niebuhr went so far as to assert that, quote, the professional class, who comprised, he believed, the most intelligent portions of American society, occupied, quote, a position of relative detachment from the ideological struggles of owners and producers. Niebuhr even redefined socialism not as the resolution of the property issue, those are his words, through workers' control of production. No, socialism now to Niebuhr was the achievement of an abundance and efficiency through benevolent managerial prowess. The modern economic order required, he now thought, quote, the best possible distribution of power for the sake of justice and the least possible management for the sake of order. A management provided precisely by the professional class, supposedly insulated from the imperatives of capital. This was the ideology of the end of ideology, as proclaimed by Daniel Bell in 1960, the exemplary post-Cold War statement of the technocratic political imagination. Niebuhr also defaulted on the racial front, endorsing the small step strategy of white liberals that Martin Luther King Jr. would later dismiss as, quote, the tranquilizing drug of gradualism. Niebuhr's reluctance to support the newly combative civil rights movement was sadly ironic, as it exemplified his prescient speculation in Moral Man, based on his observations of Gandhi's successes in South Africa and India, that, quote, there is no problem of political life to which religious imagination can make a larger contribution than this problem of developing nonviolent resistance. Yet when confronted with so glorious a confirmation as the civil rights movement, Niebuhr retreated into equivocation. The Brown decision in 1954 satisfied Niebuhr that Americans' racial divisions were, quote, on the way of being resolved because, in words that sound positively Deweyan in their optimism, quote, the general tendency of increasing social intelligence is to withdraw support from the claims of social privilege. John Dewey couldn't have said it better. Yet Niebuhr expressed sympathy with Southern white parents who feared a decline in the educational standards of integrated schools, citing, quote, cultural differences between the races. Later, responding to the Montgomery boycotts, Niebuhr went positively Burkean, invoking hoary conservative chestnuts about organic processes in an effort to convince King and other leaders of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference to check the movement's momentum. It was, quote, politically unwise to advocate gradualism, Niebuhr conceded, but it was, in his view, morally wise to practice it. We're quite a long way from the socialist firebrand of the summer of 1919. Thus, it's hard for me to see how a thinker whom the journalist Richard Rovere anointed the official establishment theologian in 1960 could pose much of a threat to, well, the official establishment. His realism dovetailed well with the sonorous rhetoric of maturity and responsibility that was the lingua franca among courtier intellectuals such as Arthur Schlesinger Jr., and imperial mandarins such as McGeorge Bundy and Robert McNamara. As Niebuhr's biographer Richard Fox has observed, Niebuhr enabled such men, quote, to maintain faith in themselves as political actors in a troubled, what he termed a sinful world. Niebuhr taught that moral men had to play hardball. Quote, covering themselves with guilt in order to fulfill some high responsibility, end quote. Cold warriors could ravage Vietnam and other nations, recalling Niebuhr's solemn benediction on, quote, conscious choices of evil for the sake of good. Niebuhr might have recalled that Pontius Pilate dispatched Jesus of Nazareth for the sake of public order. Despite his chastisement of American hubris, Niebuhr was no prophet to the establishment, as Henry F. May once dubbed him. A rueful theologian of empire, Niebuhr was a pontifex maximus for Cold War elites, among whom Christian realism offered an ideological sanction for U.S. foreign and military policy. Even if we set aside Niebuhr's reverential enlistment by the Cold War elite, his account of moral and political life is open to serious challenge. Although Niebuhr hoped that Christian realism could chasten ambition and civilize conflict, it's hard to see how it can ever do either, given Niebuhr's well-known pessimism about groups. His dismissal of the notion that nations could be self-sacrificing leads inexorably to a sense of futility, since the acute and profound consciousness of the capacity for sin that is central to Christian realism would have to be cultivated by a people, not by virtuosi and introspection. It would demand a talent for contemplation and humility that would presumably constrain their inclination to self-delusion, vengeance, and malice. Yet Niebuhr himself observed that no political community in history has ever possessed this talent, at least not in any abundance. And it is an especially difficult talent to develop when, as among Americans, the identity of that community is inseparable from a conviction of errand, destiny, providence, or century. As so often happens in his work, Niebuhr intensifies the consciousness of sin, yet offers little but rumination on the tragedy of it all. Those unwilling to make the future a hostage to tragedy must either hope that the virtues indispensable for Christian realism can be nurtured among an elite, and the track record on that score is not encouraging, or forthrightly dispute the terms of Niebuhr's pessimism. They would have to counter, in the face of the ample historical evidence to the contrary, that charity, modesty, and self-sacrifice are indeed, quote, within the realm of moral possibility for groups and nations. They would therefore have to contend with Niebuhr's insistence on realism, the feature of his political thinking that is usually considered most unassailable, but which I would suggest is in fact quite dubious and contestable. Realism, like other words such as pragmatic, efficient, responsible, or serious, has always been a formidable weapon in the rhetorical arsenal of power, indispensable for clearing and protecting the moral and epistemological high ground. Always head for the hills when you hear these words. Any challenge to Niebuhrian realpolitik must begin not by sending a banal and ineffectual idealism into battle, but by exposing the fraudulence of many a hard-boiled claim to realism. Christian realists too readily cede the power to define reality, and therefore possibility, to the professional and managerial cadres of the national security state and the corporations. Yet as Niebuhr himself might well have agreed, realism often turns out to be either an imprimatur on the status quo, a mere surrender to the actual, as the progressive writer Randolph Bourne once put it so well, or realism turns out to be nothing more than the malignant illusions of the powerful. But if realism is not what it seems, then what appears to be Niebuhr's strongest point is in fact his Achilles heel. If what often passes for realism is so thoroughly suspect, then Christian realism can be but a pious version of the counterfeit veracity of power. By deferring to the cognitive and political expertise of the imperial state, Christian realists both stoke imperial desire and thus ensure their own irrelevance and obscure the range of moral and political possibility. So rather than lament the lack of hope or idealism, today's apostates from empire must reclaim the language of realism. They must be visionaries in the proper sense of the word, people who see what's really there, in fact and latent impossibility. It may turn out, ironically, that Niebuhrian realism paralyzes the moral and political imagination, not because it is realistic, but because it is not realistic enough. The shortcomings of Christian realism were apparent to A.J. Mustey, Dutch Reformed minister, genuine socialist, and one of Niebuhr's keenest and most persistent critics. Now today, Mustey is remembered primarily as an anti-war and civil rights activist, engaging in civil disobedience with Dorothy Day, the Fellowship of Reconciliation, and the War Resisters League, and often literally holding a candle of peace against nuclear weapons in the Vietnam War. Like Niebuhr, Mustey wrote and acted on the basis of a distinctive political ontology and eschatology that challenged the realism of Christian realism. While Niebuhr was right in his view to warn that all earthly power was ultimately, quote, ephemeral, weak, and doomed, Mustey believed that history contained a wider array of possibilities. Nonviolence and radical change were practical and realistic, Mustey believed, because the love that Niebuhr banished to the end of history was available in the here and now. Quote, the divine is always about to break into history. Against Niebuhr's secular, linear, empty, homogeneous time, Mustey posed an ontological and eschatological alternative, a realized eschatology. The past, he reflected, does, quote, not simply grind out the future through the sieve of the present. For Mustey, as for Walter Benjamin, every moment was the gate through which the Messiah could enter. The present and the future are simultaneous and permeable to Mustey. The here and now is open to incursion from the kingdom. The future can interrupt and transform our time. To Mustey, every act of love was a visit to the kingdom and brings the future in the present tense. Quote, love can change history, Mustey insisted, because time, having more than one direction, is always on our side. Mustey conceded that love offered no greater guarantee of success than reliance on money or weapons, the arsenal of fear that provides the world with its bloody and evanescent security. The partisans of love would inevitably suffer obloquy, exile, even death. The main reason, Mustey suspected, that guile and violence seemed to be safer options for Christian realists. But in the end, Mustey mused, there simply is no safety in our futile efforts to secure ourselves in time. All attempts to master our fates conclude in ashes, ruin, and butchery. Nothing really belongs to us. So by accepting the vulnerability that comes with this shul of possession and violence, the pacifist, in Mustey's view, is, quote, the supreme realist. However draped in the changing rhetorical fashions of liberal democratic capitalism, the American quest for imperial mastery was yet another vain grasp at eternity. And like that of an earlier empire, this nation's pursuit of global supremacy was a snare and a delusion. Quote, in its way, the Roman Empire was real enough, Mustey wrote. But its power structure was not permanent, not real. It was a house built on sand. For Mustey, the problem lay not in the nature of groups, but in the reluctance to live without dominion. Forswearing ultimate allegiance to the principalities that are rooted in dust, any vanguard of the eschaton must be, quote, loose and experimental, in Mustey's view, living as lightly tethered as possible to the world of business and empire. They might even lead their fellow citizens to a happier, if humbler, destiny. For one never knew when the other side of history would swoop in and transform the time. Love can change history, Musty asserted, for, quote, love is mightier than dominion. To be sure, Musty could be no less insistent than Niebuhr on the ironies of historical action. Referring to the earliest Christians, who expected the heavenly city and instead got the Roman Empire, Musty observed that, quote, what came about did not resemble their dreams, but then mused that, quote, it never does. Corruption was mingled with the glory. But this recognition of the ineradicable ambiguity of history did not induce Musty, as it did Niebuhr, to counsel resignation to the sinful necessities of subterfuge and the occasional low-intensity massacre. In Musty's view, there are more things in heaven and earth than are dreamt of in realpolitik. So if, quote, reality is not what men tend to call the real, in Musty's words, if the world is an ampler and more generous place than the faithless are compelled to make it, then love is a power and not an ideal. As Musty had written in 1940, quote, there are in our universe resources for living the life of love which we have hardly begun to tap, but which we must learn to draw upon. Musty's conviction that a politics of love was more practical than Niebuhrian realism was shared by an array of Cold War radicals, often dubbed personalists by historians, the Catholic Workers, led by Dorothy Day, the participants in several communes or intentional communities, such as Clarence Jordan's Quantania Farm, the loose coalition of secular and religious intellectuals who wrote for the journal Liberation, including Musty, Day, Dellinger, Bayard Rustin, Dwight MacDonald, Paul Goodman, and a host of others who prefigured a new left dissociated from Marxism and social democracy. And eventually elements of that new left itself, the partisans of beloved community who permeated the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee and Students for a Democratic Society. What distinguished personalism from other forms of post-war radicalism was its double focus on personal and political renewal, its commitment to the idea that existential metamorphosis, what Paul Tillich called the courage to be, the fulfillment of the person's divine image and likeness, was bound up with political transformation. Tillich's theology is crucial here, as its existentialist idiom was always inseparable from radical politics. From its inception in Weimar Germany among the Kairos circle of German socialist theologians to its more muted but nonetheless influential iteration in his popular post-war work. Tillich has often been criticized, by me no less, as a herald of today's therapeutic religious culture. Although I would still affirm most of what I wrote about Tillich, I have to say that I've grown ever more fond and appreciative of his work, and one of the reasons is that which many of his readers among the New Left cited. Its intimation of what Tillich called the new reality, its resources for an expansive political imagination, its emphasis on what we call sanctification. Adumbrated in sermons such as Holy Waste, where Tillich writes with romantic flourish of a state of being that unites, quote, reason and ecstasy, moral obligation and sacred waste. This kind of politics would, unlike Christian realism, arouse our enervated powers of joy, improvisation, and conviviality, because it would arise from what William James once called the saint's spirit of ontological wonder. Musty's historical realm, always open to divinity, best transformed by a reparative and revolutionary conception and practice of politics. Indeed, I would argue that the richest troves of theo-political imagination lie in a revival and renovation of existential and liberation theology, not in the ecclesial fetishism of Stanley Hauerwas, or the theocratic fantasies of John Milbank and radical orthodoxy. Tillich and Musty's insistence on a kind of existential exuberance as the basis of a new political imagination has been paralleled by Michael Hart and Antonio Negri, who have turned St. Francis from a medieval icon into a model of contemporary militancy. Unlike the steely and domineering Leninist who harnesses the power of historical forces as defined in the precincts of Marxist realpolitik, Francis, they write, is the revolutionary who leads by the example of self-effacing yet triumphant submission to the forces at work in the universe. Just as in the poverty of his time, Francis discovered what they call the ontological power of a new society: love, simplicity, and also innocence. Reveling in what he believed to be the carnivalesque nature of God's superabundance, Francis, in their words, refused every instrumental discipline, lived a, quote, joyous life, in contrast to the skinflint sobriety enjoined by nascent capitalism, and affirmed every animal, flower, and stone, quote, posing against the misery of power, the kaleidoscopic and immeasurable joy of being, in their words. Similarly, but without Francis' sacramental ontology, today's militant Hart and Negri argue must rely on, quote, a fundamental productivity of being. Now, we may differ about the source of that fundamental productivity of being, but any new radicalism must begin from a faith in the possibilities of the here and now, a realized eschatology, if you will, the future in the present tense, living the new world in the wreckage of the old, something Reinhold Niebuhr, too sure in the serenity of the ruling elite, would not and cannot help us do. Fini.
Thank you. That was terrific. Is that a chapter in the book? No.
Well, I wrote it just for you, Charles.
No.
Yes, I did. That's no lie.
Well, it should be.
Some of it's, you know, kind of reworded from this.
Yeah, that was really
plagiarizing myself.
Really excellent. Let's actually go ahead and take 15 minutes now with some, begin the conversation, and then we'll take a break.
Sure.
Thanks. That was just so helpful and provocative. What's on your mind?
Well, I guess they agree. We're done.
No, I think we're busily trying to formulate questions. Please, Christina McCrory.
One, so I haven't been following along with class. I assume that you're talking about Niebuhr, right?
Mm-hmm. You took this class years ago, didn't you? Oh, we didn't do Niebuhr then. That's right. Yeah. Okay.
So, is Niebuhr, do you think, I know you spoke about in the class, discussing his role in American political life. Is the Niebuhrian mindset, do you think, the greatest danger to political imagination today? Or are we stuck in that mindset?
It's one of the dangers. It's one of the dangers, especially among, I think, religious public intellectuals and politicians. I'd say that overall the greatest danger to the contemporary political imagination is what Margaret Thatcher called TINA. There is no alternative. David Graeber, the anthropologist and anarchist, has written, I think, quite compellingly about what he calls a war on the imagination. The insistence to people your age and a bit younger that this is it, this is the best it gets. Neoliberalism sucks, but this is it, and you just have to get used to it. So, you know, go on your Facebook page, make yourself into a curriculum vitae rather than a person, and this is it. I think that even though Niebuhr, you know, as I said in the first part of my remarks, I think he does offer some resources for pushing back against this. I'm not convinced at all that he or those in the realist lineage can really offer an alternative. I mean, all they can do is basically say, it sucks. Maybe we can make it a little better. Maybe you can be serene. Right? So you can say your serenity prayer and just feel maybe not better, but you can feel at least, okay. So I don't think it's the greatest one, but I do think that it is maybe a cousin of the worst. Yeah.
Jay, behind you. And let's keep coming back to that.
Hi, Jay.
This is Jay Tolson, by the way. We've introduced each other before. Jay is, may I just say a word about you? You're the distinguished editor at Hedgehog Review. But for those of you who are Walker Percy fans, Jay wrote the most fabulous biography of Percy called Pilgrim in the Ruins. Oh my God! Yeah, I just get all giddy around here still. Anyway.
Well, Gene, I haven't been able to process all of these. I mean, it's typically eloquent and elegant the way you stitch together so much there. And I'm not able to formulate a response, although, like, I want to respond in an almost childlike way and say, gee, Gene, it's not really that bad.
Oh, well.
And, you know,
yes, but they're young, and we don't want to discourage.
Despairing voice that says, gosh, if we only had a Niebuhr around now, in the realm of public intellectuals. We don't. We have far less. Mm-hmm. And I think the triumph of what you call neoliberalism, a term about which I remain mm-hmm. highly skeptical for all sorts of reasons, because it seems to serve as the sort of all-purpose club for every kind of critique of everything from, you know, the Chicago gang and mm-hmm. their work in Latin America, to Margaret Thatcher, to the so-called new liberals and the Democratic Party, mm-hmm. and the Clinton, and even to the Chinese leadership, and to really everybody. So a term that's so capacious, in a way, almost serves no practical purpose. And I'd almost prefer going back to the Marxist categories and talk about capital and the powers of capital and the kind of capital.
I'm okay with that.
But I don't favor the Marxist critique,
right.
Because I think Niebuhr, and again, like many socialists, was taken up by it. But I think his disillusionment was with very real things that were happening mm-hmm. with actually existing, truly existing socialism in many parts of the world. And the responses might have been wrong, ultimately, in some
right.
ways. But it seems to me that the failures of capitalism that we now see in our society were really inflicted more by the capitalists themselves, have been inflicted, as to some extent Marx said they would, by the excessive greed that destroyed a system that actually achieved an unusual degree of economic equality. I mean, this is the Piketty argument, is that there was, thanks to the kind of hard left pressure from the left,
mm-hmm.
Thanks to sort of arranging the pressures of the war itself, thanks to an aggressive trade union movement, thanks to a host of other things, all sort of breakthroughs in technology, there was something that was achieved in American and Western society in general. Europeans went further along that line in terms of a social equality, a social democracy. And that argument, of course, never had much purchase in this mm-hmm. country. But what's been really remarkable is the way the gospel of greed has triumphed in the years since Niebuhr and has, in a sense, I think, rendered capitalism, as in my view, still the most efficient means of creating wealth, into a highly problematic system of creating wealth, because it simply becomes so concentrated. The fruits of labor, capital, have become so concentrated in the hands of not even productive owners of capital, but the least productive owners, the high financial mm-hmm. owners of capital. And that's where the crisis lies. And I wonder if your critique of Niebuhr, which I think is right, basically, but I wonder how it helps us break out of what is really the challenge now, which is both the enchantments of mammon and the enchantments of incredible PR in the form of, you know, pseudo think tankery and the influence of money behind the scene to lead to something that we have today, which is a Trump-like figure, you know, on top of the political surface, a post-political figure in many ways, or maybe he's just a continuation of the old politics of extreme right nationalism. But really, who can put together all sorts of nonsense, never substantiated, and entertain? So I would say, is Niebuhr as much responsible for this as something else in terms of intellectual failures?
Mm-hmm. My main fault with Niebuhr, at least with this talk, is with something that, you know, that I talked about at the beginning when he's talking about myth and illusion. I mean, I've become much more convinced that one of the main problems, I don't want to just say with the left, but just with political culture in general, is what I see is this increasing incapacity to formulate any idea of an alternative, right? Do I fault Niebuhr for that? Yeah, to an extent, because I think what happens when you keep telling people in book after book that, oh, you know, any attempt you make could turn out to be utopian and it could lead to the gulag, right? I just think after a while that just grinds down the capacity for imaginative thinking. I mean, do we need a kind of iconoclasm? Yeah, absolutely. I mean, get those hammers out. You know, go after advertising, go after finance capital. Learn more about the way the capitalist economy actually works. I mean, my God, don't listen to the business school. I mean, honestly, do not listen to it. I would sign on to everything you said about the post-war order, right? Only to say that I think that the stability of that New Deal order was always much greatly exaggerated. And I think a lot of recent work in political and business history has demonstrated this. Business never accepted the New Deal. Never accepted it. And what you see beginning in the 50s and 60s is a concerted effort by business elites, by certain intellectual elites, represented by the University of Chicago, but certainly not only that, to basically destroy any sort of New Deal Keynesian alternative to this. Yeah, things are much worse in a way than I sketched out. I agree.
Surely not.
Very few. I mean, yeah.
Very few. That's amazing.
Very few.
It was a small but powerful and extremely well organized.
I think part of the reason here that we don't get this is that most historians who wrote about the New Deal in the 50s and 60s were, guess what, liberal New Dealers, right, who I think overestimated the success with which they had tamed the beast. A lot of the business history that has come out over the last decade, I think, clearly indicates that corporate business never reconciled itself to the New Deal and saw every opportunity, pursued every opportunity it could to either roll it back or destroy it altogether. And now, well, they've succeeded, I mean, pretty much. And so I think that one of the main tasks of our time is to try to imagine, so how what are we going to build? Because, you know, so much about Marxism and social democracy is just dead. It's dead, right? I still think that Marxism provides, a lot of indispensable conceptual tools for understanding what's going on. But I think as a political project, it's dead. Over the last few years, have become more interested in anarchist and syndicalist literature. I mentioned David Graeber a few times in here. I looked at his work as a source of this. Now, I wouldn't identify as an anarchist, but I do think, I'm not an anarchist and I don't play one on TV, but I do think that there's a lot in anarchist literature that is much more incisive and much more hopeful about the prospects for building something, some kind of an alternative, and not, and this is the most interesting thing to me, to try, as the old wobbly slogan, right, the old IWW slogan was, to build the new society in the shell of the old, right? So it's not simply, as Marxists used to think of it, okay, we're going to have the revolution, then we're going to build the new society. I think we have to start thinking about ways to do it right now, right? I mean, this is one of the most attractive things to me, not just about the anarchist way of thinking, but also about a lot of the thinking that animated the civil rights movement and the anti-war movement. Live it now, right? Because if you keep waiting, it's never going to happen. You know, I know we roll our eyes when we hear it now, be the change that you want to see in the world. It's true. I mean, I don't care if Gandhi didn't say it or not. I mean, it seems to me that the thought and the sentiment behind it is something that we really need to recapture. And I don't think Niebuhr is going to do that. I just don't.
Can we take a three-minute break? There are a lot of questions. Don't go away. But let's just have a moment to stretch our legs and reconvene really in just 3 or 4 minutes, okay? For another half hour or so.
Oh. Great.
Thank you.
Oh, God.
You okay?
Yeah.
That was terrific. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hi. I was the person that heard that line that reported that to Charlie.
Oh, you did?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
I had a feature on that. I'm William, by the way.
Oh, hi. Nice to meet you.
Yeah,
I taught Charlie when
said that.
Yeah. He was a sophomore
at Villanova in the honors. Oh, yeah. He said I had
Oh, he's told you all about it.
Yeah. I knew the whole history.
Yeah. Yeah, Charlie.
He's actually going to be here in like a split second. That's what I figured.
Yeah, I know he was really bummed that he couldn't come.
Yeah,
but they're doing apparently one of what he called mini moons. Right?
I know they're somewhere right now. Seaworthy. But yeah, and then they're going.
Yeah.
Were you there?
Yes.
Yeah, that's what
I was there.
Okay.
Yeah.
And he said he sent the invitation. Fantastic.
Thank you.
Yeah. I did have a question, but I was reminded of the quote from Zizek where he goes, you know, we can imagine all these movies about zombies or like going to the moon and saving colonies, but we can't imagine a film that talks about, you know, small changes in the market system.
the one of his quotes that I think I always say,
yeah.
The one where he says, we can imagine the end of the world
more
readily than we can imagine the end of capital. And that's so true.
Now, here's what I want to ask. I'll ask a question like this, so you don't need to answer it. But as I'm hearing it, you're setting up a couple of options, the Negri and St. Francis option, the RO maybe. I think maybe you're, I want to hear about, okay, so you're not. Okay, that's what I'm trying to understand. It sounded like you were aligning those positions. Okay, that's important. Yeah. That's what I was going to ask. So not that, but something like a thesis. But is this the only option on the table? Or is that already limiting or imagining?
I'm needing more water. No, I think I'm okay.
You sure? Okay.
No, I'm not. I'm simply.
I mean, in that line, just a bit of a
Karl Watts and Milbank. I'm simply remembering. I think these are options that I don't think are practical.
Yeah.
I mean, if somebody wants to come in and make the argument, I'm all
sure
ears.
Yeah, I'm not sure that I do.
But I don't think as as much as I think there's a lot to what especially Karl Watts does about the need to articulate specifically Christian kind of language we're to talk about. It's still not clear to me that you can totally with secular analysis, right? You're not going to look at the gospel and learn about surface value, right? So it seems to me that there, you still have to rely on some kind of secular idiom to talk about it.
Yeah.
And I think that though, what happens though is that Stanley and even John's worse than this. Worse on this. Chuck Matthews once said something about Milbank, which I think is completely right. He said the problem with Milbank is that he can only talk about his antagonist, not to. I think that's the problem. I think Chuck's right about that.
Stanley, I think, is not quite that hermetically sealed. But yeah, Milbank Price.
I have an essay coming out in this foreign London called
Syndicate. Yeah, sure. Yeah.
It's a review of Milbank's latest book.
Yeah, the anthology.
Yeah.
What did you make of that?
Oh, I think he's a theater.
Well, yeah, of course he is. Yeah, of course.
And I just wish he would just, you know, like,
say it. What's his salary? What do you
know? And he wrote back. I mean, it's funny. Yeah. He wrote me this email.
Okay.
And he sent me this email, which was just evasive, I thought. You know, like, God, just own it.
Yeah.
Okay? Yeah. Come on. You know, I still think you're nice.
John Kelvin teaches at FSU as a professor of mine, and he was president and minister of religious work on justice and Islam, and was the author of the journal, or the editor of the journal, I think, Christian Ethics, or something like that. Had a review of the Milbank. And says I won't get because I don't know. So it's that kind of thing that I think about, is both endearing as a character and unhelpful as an interlocutor.
Yes.
But there's some kind of
John's the kind of guy who sends you a blizzard of memos. The email he sent was kind of lengthy. And I thought, John, put this in the response. Why are you sending this?
Don't waste it on me.
You know, I hope I said that. You know, why don't you just take big bleeding chunks of this and put it in the brother?
Yeah.
So maybe what he was doing was giving me a preview.
Right.
Yes, right.
Yeah, right.
But I just thought, man, come on.
Yeah.
But no, hey, listen, I mean, no, I don't want to forestall, you know, have some sort of conversation with other ones. I'm just not sure. My problem with Stanley is that whenever he talks about the church, I want to ask him, what church are you talking about exactly?
Yeah, yeah.
Like, which is everyone's question.
Right.
All right, you don't sound.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Thanks for the water.
Oh, yeah, of course. All right. As when we were, when we took a break, there were a number of Isaac, and then who had it? And then William, and then Andrew, someone else? Anyway, Isaac.
Okay. So
Isaac May?
Yes.
Okay. You're going to be in New York this week, right? For some intellectual history?
I'm going to be in D.C. for the
D.C., not New York, yeah. Okay, I saw your name on the...
Elton Trueblood.
Okay.
Wow, I remember
you. Yeah, we all know.
I have no idea how you knew that. That's interesting.
I went on Google. I mean, no. I mean, I'm not going to be at the conference this year. I mean, I usually am, but so I looked through the roster of events. And
what is the society that's meeting?
The Society for U.S. Intellectual History is meeting in D.C.
We're talking about Trueblood. Awesome.
Yeah.
Nasty things about his connection with Niebuhr. I'm on board with A.J. Musty. I was on board before I got in the room. I'm still on board with A.J. Musty. But my kind of question here is, like, I don't think anybody else is, right? Fellowship of Reconciliation, like, barely exists anymore. I've got a handful of, like, Mustyite pastors, all of whom were about 40 years older than I am. Within academia, the only pastors I've ever cited are Herr Wass and Yoder, who are coming from a totally different direction. And I get told, like, go and look at the people in the emergent church who are doing something totally different. You're kind of tracing an intellectual genealogy here in which you're like, well, these people go into FDS, but that doesn't look super similar to me, and FDS isn't really around anymore either.
Mm-hmm.
Where is this kind of, like, where do you go if you're like, I'm on board with A.J. Musty, I don't like Reinhold Niebuhr?
Well, as Jay said, things are really bad, right? Worse than Okay, I know this answer is going to sound evasive, but I don't care. You have to make it. I mean, you know, you have a lineage, and I think once you know that lineage, you insert yourself into it, right? SDS and SNCC didn't just happen, right? I mean, they realized that they saw a lineage, they saw people who were part of a tradition, and they decided that they would join it, right? I know that sounds overly what I think is sometimes called voluntarist, as in, you know, we can just make this out of our own will, we can make it out of our own agency. But again, I mean, this is something that I think anarchists are better at explaining than socialists or Marxists have been. Well, we have to have the right historical conditions, we have to have the right political conditions. Jesus Christ. I mean, you know, it's never going to happen then. You know, so you have to make it. And, now here's the second part of the answer, I think a lot of these ideas have been very well preserved among secular thinkers who have been interested in religion lately. I would mention Simon Critchley as one. I wish that people would read a lot of Simon Critchley. Faith of the Faithless is a really interesting book. The subtitle is Experiments in Political Theology. Žižek, Slavoj Žižek, with all his tics, is one that has talked about some of this. Terry Eagleton, one of my favorite people. Now, I personally don't think he's a Marxist anymore. I mean, I think he plays one on TV, but I don't think he really is anymore. Eagleton, I wrote an article in Dissent about Eagleton last year, if you're all interested to read it. Eagleton used to be what they called a New Left Catholic in the 1960s. He wrote some really fascinating stuff in the 60s that I think bears rereading. Then he went off and did the prodigal son routine for about three decades, right, when he became thought of himself as a Marxist. And in the last decade, I would say, he has slowly come back to Catholicism in his inimitable way. I think that his recent work is worth looking at as well. So I don't think that a lot of this has actually disappeared. It's just gone sort of underground, or it's taken odd forms, because for some reason Christians have either disavowed it. I was just reading something by Marilyn Robinson this week in Commonweal, where she was writing about why liberal Protestantism has you know, declined, and basically it's because they don't seem to have any faith in their lineage anymore. You know, you won't hear Niebuhr's name, or even H. Richard Niebuhr's name, or any of these names mentioned in liberal Protestant congregations anymore. I mean, I don't know about seminaries, but they're just not talked about. Tillich, especially. I mean, I don't know how many people have heard of Paul Tillich now. I can't even assume that some of my students have heard of Paul Tillich, and if I mention them, it dates me, which is not a good feeling. But you know, Paul Tillich. So yeah.
So how does that make you feel, Isaac?
Does that
sounds like a large quantity of the stuff on my bookshelf? But again,
you're off to the right start.
Political activist to like hang out with, right? It still seems like a handful of intellectuals who are out there. But
handfuls are where it always begins.
I have to follow up to that, to which you might give the same answer.
Ditto.
One of my favorite parts of your talk was your critique of the modern political situation, especially in America, as lacking imagination. And I was really impressed with the way that you connected that to Niebuhr. So I'm wondering, this is to some degree a pedagogical question, but how do you teach imagination to people who are not interested in cultivating it and are also not asking for a reading list, right? What are ways of opening that up to students, especially since we're in an academic institution?
Ditto. No, seriously, I think that part of the impoverishment imaginative impoverishment that I think a lot of students have had inflicted on them is only perpetuated by the fact that when they get to colleges or universities, these people are never offered to them to read. Never. Or seldom. I teach at Villanova, a Catholic university. The only place Dorothy Day or Peter Moran or a host of other people, I mean, not just Dorothy Day, I'm kind of Dorothy Day'd out, at this point, to some degree. The only place you will ever see them talked about is the Peace and Justice program, right? So they're kind of sequestered right there. And if you don't, if other students are not introduced to it, whether it's in the year-long intellectual history required freshman, right, two-semester course that they're supposed to take, if it's not there, they're probably never going to see it again anywhere, even at Villanova. And Villanova Catholic University, you're not going to get it there. I mean, I don't know about UVA, but
no, you're
certainly not going to get it, in a lot of other places. I'm just astonished sometimes at the lethargy of some of my colleagues in this regard. Oh, we'll just drop her name and maybe they'll read her. No, you can't assume that. You have to, introduce them. And I think that once you introduce them, I've often seen people get interested.
Tell stories.
Yeah. I mean, look, I teach a lot of business students, believe it or not. And they're nice kids. And some of the best students are business students. Sorry, I'm not going to go on. They will tell you unbidden, the system sucks. They will say it without my having to say anything, without a lot of my other colleagues saying anything. They will tell you that this system is terrible, but they have no alternative. They can't think of an alternative. And part of the reason they can't is that my colleagues have not even tried often to provide them with one, right? So I think there's actually a great big untapped reservoir of discontent out there that needs to be tapped because it's there.
Christina and then William. And then Russell. Okay.
So it seems to me that one of the reasons it's so hard to imagine an alternative to our contemporary system is because the rhetoric of capitalism lately, I'm talking about since the 1970s, since the ascendancy of the neoliberal, has been that markets are fairly mechanical, that they work according to their own natural laws, mm-hmm. and that it's only if we leave them alone to function in that way that
right.
we will reap the benefits.
Mm-hmm.
This to me seems like an incredibly damaging rhetoric for political machinations, for moral machinations more generally.
Mm-hmm.
I take heart from the fact that I think that rhetoric is fracturing a little bit in the last 5 years. Not a lot. We're not blowing it wide open.
Right.
But it seems to be cracking at the edges a little bit. We're realizing it's not bearing the weight that it was meant to bear. It's not mapping on to the way markets actually work. And so I take heart in developments like Piketty and the fact that there's wild success when he's saying, whoa, capitalism is actually contingent, and we can change the outcome.
Mm-hmm.
But it happened lately, because that to me seems an incredibly radical thing. Do you take any hope in that?
Yes.
Okay.
I do. I'm not on board with a lot of Piketty's, what I imagine to be pretty much social democratic reforms, right, for this. I don't want to say I'm optimistic. I'm certainly hopeful when I see things like the success of Piketty's book. What I wonder, though, is whether Piketty's book is kind of like Stephen Hawking's book, right, from the 1980s. I think it was called A Brief History of Time. Lots of people bought it, but then they opened it, and they got about 10 pages into it and thought, I think I'll read something else. Yeah. So I wonder, that's the only thing I wonder about with Piketty. I mean, it's a big wonder. But again, I think that in order for this discontent with contemporary capitalism to bear any meaningful political fruit, there has to be some conception of, okay, so what comes next, right? Sure, am I enthusiastic about Bernie Sanders? Sure, you know, absolutely. I wonder if a lot of what he has proposed as an alternative is either A, going to be enacted by, you know, an insane Congress, or number two, whether in some ways it actually reproduces some of the, I think, more fundamental problems with capitalist economics, right? I mean, this automation, mechanization, the increasing alienation of labor, you know, these kinds of things. Yeah. So am I hopeful? Yes, always. Optimistic? Well, I think it's, again, it's important to be hopeful. I just optimism is an overrated virtue. You know, hopefulness is not even mentioned, and there's a huge difference between the two of them. Hope, you're always ready for whatever comes, right? Even if it's good. So, I'm actually hopeful that good things are coming. It's just that Niebuhr's not going to bring us there, I think. So.
Thank you again. This was really wonderful. I would just add to you mentioned Marilynne Robinson. I don't know if you read Robert Pogue Harrison, but he's doing similar things coming from a Catholic. I guess he's a lapsed Catholic of some kind, but is doing some really interesting work.
Who is that?
Robert Pogue Harrison. He's
Pogue?
A book called Juvenescence.
Pogue Harrison?
P-O-G-U-E.
Okay.
So I'm really curious, when you were saying imagining other political ontologies, I don't know if that's okay, and I kind of think of, personally, from where I'm coming from, I'm also really interested in the way that, let's say, the Fugitives, the poetry circle, write about new ways of thinking, the kind of, here I stand, I'll take my stand collection, or even Eugene Genovese's The Southern Tradition, and the whole argument is that the South had always had this sense that it was Northern Republican capitalists who were clouding precisely this kind of damaging language underneath, or damaging practices underneath the language of freedom and rescue and righting wrong. And so I'm wondering about the limits of kind of the fascination of Wendell Berry, home economics, or the front porch Republicans.
Some of whom are in my department at Villanova.
Well, that's what I figured. And so I was actually really interested to get your take on if there's a possibility of linking arms there, or if those are so discontiguous that there isn't a possibility on that front.
I'm not optimistic.
Okay.
And I'll tell you why.
Yeah.
I'm not even hopeful. I mean, I'm going to be honest with you on that one. First of all, because I reject the idea, there's been a lot that's been written over the last 5 years, especially about slavery and capitalism, and the Eugene Genovese line has, I think, been completely demolished. This idea that slavery represented not just the economy, but the plantation culture represented some kind of, I don't know, aristocratic mint julep, you know, alternative to it. I think it's just been demolished by people like Edward Baptist, especially. So that's why I think specifically in terms of the Fugitives or the Southern Agrarians, right, I'm not entirely sure that I think that the political economy that they advance in the 1930s was really all that different from what you could call small-scale capitalism. And in my view, small-scale capitalism inevitably ends up with large-scale capitalism, right? I don't think that there's some kind of way that it can't evolve into that. Wendell Berry is an interesting case to me because I'm known in my department as the anti-Wendell Berry guy. I think somewhat unfairly. I mean, I only trash him occasionally, not all the time. So I like Wendell Berry. I think he's a great writer. I think his critiques of industrialized agriculture are, you know, invaluable and indisputable. My problem with Berry is I can never detect in his writing a vision for urban life, right? I mean, what are we who live either in cities or close to cities, what are we supposed to do? We can't all go off to Kentucky and grow tobacco. So what do? I mean, wear a hair shirt? You know, even if we live, maybe. You know, I don't know. Maybe we should. But I don't see in Bear, again, I see his alternative, but I wonder both if it's practicable and even if it's desirable. So, and this is the fruit of many conversations with some of the front porch Republic types. Mark Schiffman and James Wilson, especially, are in my department. I respect them immensely. I just think they're dead wrong about a number of things. So, I'm sure they think the same way of me. I don't know about the respect part, but I know that they're, they think I'm wrong. So,
Russell and Jesse.
Sure. Yeah, mine's probably a little more relevant. A lot of numbers raising my hand, but sort of returning to your, if you're talking about lack of political imagination and sort of the political climate of not being able to consider alternatives. And my first question is, does that conviction come from sort of a general dissatisfaction with everything that's on the table right now, in the sense that, well, there's got to be something else? Or you've mentioned some writers, all of whom I'm unfamiliar with. Are there ideas out there that you think have traction and are actionable and offer things better that no one is talking about? And if so, what are those?
I do think there's a dissatisfaction with what's on offer. I think this explains why you have such a large number of people who are going to the speeches of an avowed socialist. I mean, we haven't seen this since Norman Thomas in the 30s, I think, where you have an avowed democratic socialist attracting lots and lots of people. And not just, as that nitwit David Brooks writes, it's not just in university towns. I mean, this is a really dismissive way that Brooks uses to try to get rid of Sanders. Well, it's those pointy-headed intellectuals, in universities who go to see Sanders. Well, that just isn't true. Lots of reporters have commented on this, that all kinds of people are going to hear Sanders speak. Even if they come away unconvinced, the reason that they've gone is that they look not just at the GOP, but they also look at what's on offer with the Democrats and are just, I've heard this before. As far as what I see to be at least the sources of alternatives, as I said, I think that one of the reasons that the anarchist tradition has undergone something of a revival over the last, I'd say, decade, before Occupy, I should add, is that anarchism part of it, I think, is always this kind of, ooh, anarchism. I mean, there's a tradition that's really exotic, right? It's like, National Geographic in the closet when you were 12, right? Ooh, yeah, this is how I'm going to really get the parents going. I think that's part of it. I think that that's part of it. But I also think it's because, look, so many other traditions of the left are exhausted. Marxism shot the bolt in 1989. Social democracy has essentially become neoliberalism. Why is everybody in Britain so scared of Jeremy Corbyn? Right? Because he actually represents an alternative, right? Now, whether or not that alternative is one that, we would want, that's another question. That's why I think that a lot of these traditions that are associated with anarchism, syndicalism, what's often called guild socialism, had a rather large following in Britain in the early 20th century. These are, in a sense, paths not taken. And I think that what we need to do is find, the roadmaps that these sorts of movements had and at least look at them so that we can then begin the process of thinking, okay, these are good principles, these are good ideas, how might we reconstruct them for the 21st century. I think it's also going to mean, and I think this is something that underlies a lot of our unease, I think that any sort of real alternatives to the present are going to involve downward mobility. They are going to involve Americans giving up certain things that they have become used to. And I think most Americans realize this, and this is one of the reasons why they are paralyzed. Because they realize, oh my God, there's a lot of stuff I have in my house that I'm not going to have if we actually go if we actually have an alternative that's practicable and good. That's a big deterrent. I think that's something that we're going to have. That's one fundamental thing we're going to have to deal with. You will not have the material level of abundance you have now. You won't. It will be more. It should be more equitably distributed. I mean, you know, I don't know about here at UVA, but one of the phrases I constantly heard Villanova is, "So what do you want to do? Have us all live in shacks?" You know, as though a shack is the only alternative to a McMansion, as though there's nothing in between. This is really scary to a lot of people.
So. Jesse, Luke, Jay, May.
So my question is, and this might seem really ridiculous, but what's so bad about now? Why do we need an alternative?
How much time have we got?
I feel like this. I mean, we're all sitting in Charlottesville at the University of Virginia. Life's pretty good, most of us.
For now.
Why the alternative?
For now.
And sure, we can critique. You know, I don't like Donald Trump either. But what's the local community? I feel like so much of our life is determined by the local community, and. Why should we change? Why the alternative? Why do we need that?
Oh, because I think the system that we have now is hurtling toward catastrophe. That's why. And it's already beginning.
Based on how do we know that?
Okay, I could be sardonic here and simply say open the paper. Look at the newspaper. Well, I'll give one that might be very relevant to some people in this room, student debt. I mean, I don't know how many UVA students, have student debt, what the level of that student debt is. But once you understand that student debt is higher than credit card debt, that's a lot of debt. And that debt is never going to be paid. It is not. Any decent specialist on American debt is going to tell you that. It will not be paid. So you will have a lot of defaulting people, which means you will have a lot of people who will not be able to buy homes, cars, lots of things to keep the economy running. That's only one thing, right? Increasing inequality. And I don't just mean in the sense that you have that fabled 1% versus the 99%. And I'm not just talking about the 10th of 1% versus everybody else. I'm talking about the fact that the downward pressure on wages, which we've had since the 1970s, has intensified over the last 5 to 6 years. You guys are walking into a headstorm that you really need to know about. Here's my third example, which I always love to try on business students because they're all about technological innovation. Automation. The Economist, hardly a bastion of Bolshevik thinking, right? The Economist has published several articles which would indicate that about 40% of today's jobs are going to be automated out of existence in the next 30 years. That's going to cause a lot of unemployed people, many of them with college degrees, many of them with business degrees. So the idea that a business degree is going to guarantee you some kind of a spot in life, let me tell you right now, it's not. Not. So, I know that maybe is not a convincing case, but I hope I have planted the seeds of fear.
Yeah, no.
Okay.
That's not nearly as frightening as the apocalyptic scenarios that we encountered 30 years ago. We thought there was going to be a nuclear war, and we were making decisions about not having children, and
right.
We were preparing for the end of days. We were certain in our big protest in Cambridge, Mass. that we would not, you know, live to see our children grow up, and we made the gamble and had kids. And, you know, I mean, it just sounds it doesn't sound like that big a deal what you just said. I mean, that thing, these are surmountable issues. These are at least the ones you mentioned. One can imagine policy resolutions to each of those that are feasible.
Not I think within the existing paradigm of political economy. I don't think you're going to see them. In order for example, for higher wages, right, to get some kind of higher wages, you would have to have a revitalized labor movement. Okay, that's a joke, right? Because I don't see, at least in the current circumstances, a revitalized labor movement. Partly because I think of the relentless assault on unions over the last 40 years from both business and the state. And also because I think, again, the imagination of labor unions has been constricted. We want higher wages and better benefits. Well, you tried that route during the Cold War New Deal era, and where did it end up? Here, right? So I think actually, if we want, and that's just one example, a new labor movement, it should be, I think, patterned after the Wobblies, the IWW, not the AFL-CIO. The AFL-CIO route got us here. And that's not even to mention climate change. Did I mention climate change?
No, we had Luke, and then Jay, and then May, and then Russell. Luke, it's all yours, man.
Yeah, I was going to mention we should be afraid of climate change, too.
Gun violence. Look, gun violence.
Right.
You said a while back that you weren't sure if, you know, Niebuhr's still being taught in liberal Protestant seminaries. Well, I can say from experience that he most certainly is. I don't think I've had a class for the past, like, 10 years that hasn't had it on the syllabus. And so it's sort of from that experience that my question comes. I'm fully persuaded. I like what you said to praise Niebuhr, and I'm fully persuaded by your criticisms. But I wonder, do you think you can bury Niebuhr without a direct engagement with his theological anthropology? What you've provided is a critique of his framework's function on our political imagination, and you've provided some really compelling alternatives. For me, you know, compelling alternatives. But do you think that's enough? I guess part of the question is, do you think that perhaps to the extent that there's some enduring appeal or some enduring intellectual currency to Niebuhr's form of realism, how much of that, if any, comes down to his account of the human predicament, right? The human person, which that was so crucial for Niebuhr.
Right.
Do you see that as part of the enduringness of Niebuhr? And if so, is it enough to provide us with alternative possible political ontologies, theological anthropologies, or whatever? Or do you think we'll have to address that full on straightforwardly, his own theological anthropology?
Oh, I do. I think one of the critiques, another critique that I would make of Niebuhr is, it's also I don't know if this is a critique so much of Augustine, even, because there's many different ways in which, you know, obviously you can interpret Augustine, but I think part of the enduring appeal of Niebuhr is that we like to hear awful things about ourselves, right? We like to be told that you really are Hobbesians at heart, right? You know, you really do think that you're a selfish, brutish, awful person, right? And of course, we've been told this since Augustine, that, you know, you're awful, brutish, terrible people, right? And there's something about us, I think, likes to hear that, right? Because it means that we don't have to try too hard, right? Now, without going Pelagian, right, I think that Mustes offers something of a better anthropology and also a different political ontology. Because, as Musty would sometimes put it, yes, sin abounds, but grace abounds more. Right? I think there's something about Niebuhr's anthropology and something about Niebuhr's theology that, on some level, doesn't capture the power of grace, that doesn't capture the power of love. And I think Musty's does. I'd almost want to say that that's the fundamental difference between the two of them. It's not political. It's really ontological and even eschatological, you know, as I suggested in here. I think that one of the ways in which you can understand the trajectory of a political theology is to look at its eschatology, is the way that it thinks about ontology and eschatology. I think we think too much in terms of political space, right? I do think Milbank's right about this. As much as I think John is crazy, you know, in wanting, I think, a theocracy, in effect. I think what he says about time and space is actually right. That part of our problem is that we've thought about the secular more in terms of space than in terms of time. And I think that actually the radicalism of Musty's eschatology comes from his conception of time, not of space, right? We're all concerned about, you know, the place of theology in public life, or we want a secular space and we want a religious space, right? I don't think we think enough in terms of temporality and asking, is it possible, as Musty argues, that when you see something like a civil rights movement, you're seeing what Tillich called a kairos, right? There's an opening in time when in some sense the future pays a visit to the present. And what you're doing is you're capturing that and living it out. I know that, I mean, that's kind of a mind-bending conception of time, but it seems to me it's essential to a political eschatology. I think Niebuhr's conception of time is, yep, it's one damn thing after another. And love, well, you know, love schmov, right? I mean, that comes at the end of history. Yeah, abandon that.
May?
You ready?
Yeah, sure. Thank you so much for having me.
Mm-hmm.
You mentioned during your talk that one of your reservations about Tillich was that he kind of has this therapeutic resonance. So I'm wondering how much you see therapeutic elements of our modern culture insofar as they encourage us to locate our problems within ourselves instead of in social structures as another limitation on the political imagination. And insofar as that often comes out of the religious and political left, you know, how does the left deal with that?
Well, I think this is a point I made throughout my first book, that I think there's a sense in which what we have to do is recapture the therapeutic, right? Not to repudiate it, because therapy involves the language of cure, the cure of souls. And this is a long and venerable way, it seems to me, of talking about not just religion, but religion and social and political life. So I don't want to completely abandon the therapeutic in the way that, say, Philip Reeve did or Christopher Lash did. I think they were fundamentally wrong about the way they thought about the therapeutic. Tillich's problem, I think, is that maybe you could call this an ecclesiological problem, right? I mean, Tillich's problem, I thought, was it too often devolves into these abstractions, right? So we talk about the absolute or ultimate concern or something like this. I mean, here I am laughing at that language. I mean, on one level, I'm sympathetic with his argument that how else do you speak to a secular culture? And, you know, you do have to speak to a secular culture. You can't just talk, you know, you can't just go theological immediately. But on the other hand, I think that what that ended up in is a kind of New Agey, you know, I mean, what are trot out the stereotypes, you know, assailant, you know, est kind of, oh, if I feel good about it, I guess that I'm in touch with the absolute, you know, or something like this. The left has either, I think, tended to just reject all talk of the therapeutic as, well, that's just another sign of bourgeois capitalist decadence. Or, as you suggest, they've actually encouraged it in some ways by talking about personal renewal as though it could be uncoupled from political transformation, which is what I think pretty much happened in the... I think that the great divorce there came in the 70s, when a lot of people in the New Left basically decided, well, the political route is exhausted. There's no way it's going to happen. So what I should do is I should work on myself. Okay, you know, work on yourself. Breathe better. You know, whatever. But it's not going to change the world. So that's... But the thing is, though, that's also, again, part of what I like about Tillich. Right? Because so much left writing and speechifying can be so solemn and pessimistic and oh everything's just my God, people aren't going to listen to that after a while. Right? One of the reasons I think that the left hasn't done so well is that they're so damn boring. You know, they're so downbeat, you know. Yes, be iconoclastic. Yes, be critical. But, you know, what are you going to offer me? Occupy exemplified this. You know, I know you're not supposed to speak badly of Occupy.
It's okay. Reassure you.
I think, you know,
worry
Occupy... There was so much I liked about Occupy in Philly, right? I mean, I didn't go to Zuccotti Park, but I went to Occupy Philly. And I've written about this. I was there for 4 hours, and I knew this wasn't going anywhere. Because where's the plan? Right? I mean, people are not going to follow you if they're 50 years old, their mortgage is in trouble, and their job is tenuous, and you tell them, well, we'll figure it out. They're not going to listen to that. You have to have some kind of an idea of where you want to go. Now, you know, was Occupy, I think, a great moment in sparking this kind of imagination? Yes. And that's why I think it's invaluable. And also because one of the things that I noticed about Occupy Philly was something that was also noticed about a lot of other of the Occupy occupations, which was the spirit of love. I don't think that was just a lot of twaddle. I mean, I really think that was genuine. That's the kind of thing, it seems to me, that is going to generate a new left. If anything, it's not going to be a Marxist analysis of the conditions of, you know, objective possibility, you know, this kind of thing.
Can I jump in right there and a question?
Sure.
Kind of your criticism of the Occupy movement. How does that apply to sort of Black Lives Matter movement? I think about, you know, Ta-Nehisi Coates with his new book. That's really insightful criticism, but kind of devoid of a lot of hope and constructive proposals and all that. You kind of juxtapose that with the Charleston shooting and the church reaction to that, where it's just kind of complete forgiveness. But then I read an article this week talking about how a lot of the kind of Black Lives Matter people in South Carolina were a little upset about that because it seemed to kind of stymie some of their like ability to protest. And that kind of stuff, so there's a little bit of tension there. How do you kind of, what's sort of your assessment of that? Hearing your critique of the Occupy.
Well, I can't comment on Ta-Nehisi Coates' book because it's on my, as they say, my pile. I have not read it yet. And I'm not going to go the Rod Dreher route of going on the American Conservative and basically reviewing a book he has not read. I mean, and he openly says this. I haven't read this book, but I'm going to write 2,000 words about it anyway. I think some to the extent that I'm familiar with the Black Lives Matter movement, I think, yeah, some of the same criticisms I would apply there would be, again, protest essential, confrontation essential, but what sort of larger vision is this about? Yeah, and that's where I think both it has been a spark to political imagination, to new kinds of political imagination, but I want to see more, right? So I don't want to, as with Occupy and the Black Lives Matter movement, I don't want to be so critical as to squash any gestating alternative there. So I want to give it time. And I used to be critical, I used to think that a lot of the defenses of Occupy, as in, well, you got to give it time because, you know, the civil rights movement took years to unfold. You know, I used to be impatient with that, but I'm not anymore. You know, I think that's right, that you do need to give these things time. So I think the criticisms should be, I don't think they should be ginger criticisms, but I think they should be tentative and supportive. I mean, there's destructive criticism and there's constructive. So I think, you know, constructive criticism is kind of nice.
This understanding, like the civil rights movement, as you said earlier, is like a Kairos moment, rather than yeah. kind of spatial terms as, you know, kind of overlapping religious and political.
Yeah.
That,
yeah. Could be. You know, probably is.
To be patient with the movement? Like, what's the kind
yeah.
of benefit of that?
Yeah. Well, I think patience is a virtue for a number of reasons. You know, to be old-fashioned. Patience is a virtue because things like a kairos take time to unfold. I mean, a kairos doesn't just, you know, like happen. It's not a Damascus moment necessarily. You know, and even Damascus moments, there's a backstory, right? I mean, I don't think it's just, yeah, Paul gets hit one day, and if you look back at his past, there was nothing that could have indicated that. No. No, I think that there's always something that you can identify when you look back retrospectively as, oh yeah, that Damascus moment was going to happen. And when it happened, he was ready to know it was a Damascus moment. So that's why I think you need patience, because these things take time to understand what they are.
Can I jump in for a second?
Yeah, please.
I don't actually see the Black Lives Matter and Occupy movements as analogous in this sense, because while the Occupy movement was about a set of policy goals, perhaps changing Wall Street and regulation of Wall Street. In fact, we bailed out, you know, mm-hmm. many people on Wall Street. The Black Lives Matter movement is about cultural change. We already have procedurally equality under the law. It's about making the culture match the laws. So there are many things that they've won that are, you know, actual, like reviews of certain cases and whatnot where malfeasance was done. But they're more looking for, like, a wide-scale transformation of the way America thinks about things. And the very fact that the ongoing publicities of the incidents that have been going on all along, the very fact that they're now on the front pages every time they happen, I think is a sign of success already of Black Lives Matter. So yeah, I actually don't fault them for not having more on their agenda, because the agenda is clear to me. It's a cultural transformation in the way we think about race and carrying out the criminal justice system.
Okay. Yeah, that makes sense. It makes it more difficult to...
doing what it needs to do.
Yeah. Makes it more difficult to determine, like, when something has been...
successful.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because the very fact that it's successful is why we feel like there's no progress being made. That's us waking up to the fact that there's no progress being made and then getting outraged about it. That's success.
Yeah, but as Balthazar says, success is not a gospel category, right? So it's not about achieving these signs of success as much as it would be, it seems to me, what they're suggesting is a kind of witness to something real mm-hmm. that may not be awoken until you, like, shine the light on it.
Mm-hmm. Which right? they're doing, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I think so.
I mean, it's interesting you say this, because I think one thing that Christian radicals, I've said this to you before, that one of the things that Christian radicals don't know how to deal with is success. Right? I mean, Christian radicals often have, this is part of the downside, I think, of existentialist modes of thinking, which is, yeah, you know, we're always going to be defeated. Well, what happens if you win? Right? You know, what are you going to do if people actually start saying, yeah, you know, you're right about that. Yeah, you know what? We really should tear down capitalism. Yeah, you know what? You know, we really should, you know, stop cops from beating up black people. Yeah, we really should. What are you going to do? I have a feeling that a lot of Christian radicals would absolutely soil their underwear if they actually had people say to them, yeah, we're with you. Because that would then lead to the specter of actually, now here I'm going to sound the Borean. God forgive me. They actually have to start taking responsibility. You know, because once you succeed, you then have something that you have to protect. And you have to find institutional means to do that.
The Southern tradition is precisely the sense that it has some responsibility to its history, knowing that that history is, distraught with all kinds of, haunting reminders of its horrific past, right? The new fugitive movement was kind of born out of that sense that you can't whitewash history, but you certainly can try to take it upon yourself as a burden, right? So it seems like there's actually, I understand because I know Matt Wilson, but like it seems like there's a possibility of those things linking up at some moment of thinking constructively and desertion and thinking and protest together.
Jay, you had your hand up a while ago.
No, I'm suspicious of the fugitives and the agrarians profoundly, for similar reasons to yours, but even more. I think they were. I think some of them have dealt in all kinds of bad faith. That's another
story.
But it seems to me. I mean, I should say I thought it was better than you said, thing, and worse.
Right.
The better side, it seems to me, you kind of open with an allusion to Graeber and other anthropologists and this new anarchism movement. And I find that a very interesting line of thought.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder, rather than dismiss business school types, and I know you're not completely doing that, you're doing that speechlessly, but I think one of the interesting things I see among young business school aspiratual business school is this idea of social entrepreneurship. I think it's a very pie-in-the-sky thing in many ways. On the other hand, I think it is an attempt to put into real, current, contemporary terms some of the spirit of what Graeber and others are talking about. I mean, Graeber comes from a position of profound disillusionment with solutionism, with the,
right.
the sort of the state's imposition of a kind of order that makes things worse, ultimately, and that comports with the worst tendencies of capitalism.
Right.
It seems to me that social entrepreneurialism, if it can be, really investigated by those who do it and those who look at it, is a very hopeful direction, even for the sort of urban sort of localism that you say Wendell Berry scans. I think it's already happening, by the way. I mean, it's already, there are real movements in that direction that are, I think, hopeful and that could draw very much on the insights of Graeber, and particularly this anti-solutionism that is kind of needed, that the faith in the bureaucratic order, the bureaucratic logic, which has now become, as you say, sort of married to capital and the worst aspects of capital, isn't going to lead to any kind of solution. It's going to make things worse, usually. I think there is a hopeful strain in that.
I do. The very fact that you have something called social entrepreneurship certainly indicates that there is, to some degree, a consciousness among business students that capitalism, if you leave it to its own devices, is destructive. And so I wouldn't want to, dampen, that kind of energy and imagination. I mean, I guess what I would always, though, remind social entrepreneurs is that the logic of capitalism is going to subvert what they want, right? And so therefore, it seems to me, if you want to be a social entrepreneur, I guess what I'm bridling at is the word entrepreneur, because I have all kinds of connotations you know, about that word and its association with capitalist business imperatives. I like the term anti-solutionism because that's exactly what Graeber, I think, has been advocating. Because if somebody asked him once, so are you a small C communist in the sense that, you know, anarcho-communism, Kropotkin, you know, all these guys, and he said, well, my interest is not right now so much in the property question as much as it is getting us to the point where everybody can be in on the conversation about the property question. And I think that is an attractive way to think about it. I think Graeber's absolutely right about that. What we need to have is a discussion again about what property is, right? What it's supposed to be for. But we can't do that unless we overcome the current system, right? That's why it's interesting to me that Graeber talks a lot about, not just about anarchism, but about democracy in the broadest possible way. Then he thinks, you know, we will settle the property question. Okay.
So, hey, Mina. Thank you. This has been terrific. And thanks to all of you, guests and class. This has been a really helpful afternoon and lively exchange.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks so much.
Putting up with me.